This week's Something Wild podcast is sponsored by Pelletieri Associates, an award-winning team of landscape architects celebrating over 30 years of land planning, fine gardening, masonry, poolscapes, and maintenance services throughout New England, and a proud supporter of NHPR.
I'm Chris Martin from New Hampshire Audubon, and this is Something Wild. Today, we're joined by Mike Marchand, a wildlife biologist with the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. Mike, thanks for being here.
Yeah, great to be here.
So, I'm a bird guy, and my buddy Dave Anderson knows a lot about trees. And it kind of pains me to say this, but there's a lot of New Hampshire nature that's not birds and trees. So that's actually why we brought you in to talk about snakes. Yeah. And so I think probably the most common snake in the state is the garter snake. Is that right?
Yeah, it's always great to talk snakes, so it's exciting to be here. And garter snakes are very common. They're found statewide, and they're found in a bunch of different habitat types, or what we call generalist animals, and so they can use a wide variety of different habitats. Mm-hmm. And I've seen them on the seacoast. I've seen them in cities in Manchester and Concord, and I've actually even seen them up at 4,000 feet in elevation up on Mount Isolation in the White Mountains.
Wow.
So they're quite a wide range of habitat use in the state.
So one thing about snakes, they're reptiles, and they're cold-blooded, which is different than birds or mammals. And so being cold-blooded in a northern climate, it has its own challenges, doesn't it? How do they survive in the winter?
So reptiles are getting their temperature and their activity from the surrounding environment. So their internal body temperature often mirrors the external temperature. And so when it's really warm, they tend to be really active. And when it tends to be cooler, they tend to slow down. And so different species have different ways to deal with that. But all of our species become relatively inactive during the wintertime. They seek shelter, generally underground.
So there's a problem I see coming here. In the winter, it gets below freezing. What happens to you if you're a cold-blooded animal when it's below freezing?
Yeah,
how do you do that?
So different species have different levels of cold tolerance, and some species, like wood frogs, can actually freeze fairly solid and then thaw in the spring.
Whoa.
However, most snakes tend to keep their body temperature a little bit higher. Garter snakes are more cold tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. And winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
What tactics do they use to avoid freezing, though? They must do something unusual that maybe a bird doesn't do.
Yeah, so come fall, when the temperature starts to cool down, garter snakes and other snakes will tend to seek shelter underground. And so they'll look for suitable places where they can not freeze during the winter. So that might be some rocky substrate, or it might be a rotting log underground, or there's even references them to hibernating in ant mounds.
So this time of year, in the early spring, what are garter snakes doing now?
So garter snakes will start to come out probably before many of the other snakes. They're mm-hmm. fairly cold tolerant, and they can start to appear when the ground starts to thaw and you start to get some warm days. So they're coming out of their winter hibernation, and they're starting to look for food and mates. And so they'll basically start their active season, mm-hmm. Which will last until could last into the fall.
So they're out for 6 months or so, maybe 7 months, and then in a state of torpor of some sort, and for 5 months.
Yeah, they're fairly inactive during the winter time, not doing much of anything. They're not feeding mm-hmm. once they find that suitable hibernation. But during the summertime, they're basically active for a little bit more than half the year.
So in the spring, as things are greening up, one of the snake associations that I can think of is walking through the woods or walking along a dirt road and finding a whole mass of snakes, oftentimes garter snakes from what I recall, together in a group at where you can't even tell whose head and whose tail is which. I think I know what's going on there, but can you tell me?
Sometimes those suitable places for them in the winter, we call them hibernacula, are limited. And so sometimes snakes will group up and what we call communal hibernaculum. And that's more common as you go further north, because those suitable hibernaculum to survive the winter are actually more limited. There's actually sites in Manitoba, Canada, where there's 10,000 animals that hibernate in one location.
Are you kidding me?
No, it's an attraction now. People go there to see the snakes, and it's quite a cool thing.
So I thought That's not the answer I was expecting. Yeah. I thought you were going to tell me they were mating. So isn't there a time when snakes are in a like a mating ball where they're all massed together?
Well, they'll certainly take advantage of their opportunities when they're together in the spring. And when there's sites where there's communal hibernaculum, where there's large individuals, they can mate in the spring. But I've also seen them mating throughout the summer into the fall. And the females can actually store sperm for up to a year and use that sperm in the following season to become reproductive. And
So the chance, when I see a group of snakes all coiled together, there's a really good chance it's related to warmth, is what you're saying.
Well, they could be just coming out of a communal hibernaculum.
If it's in the spring,
for example. But they will kind of ball up during reproduction, and a lot of times you'll find one large snake, which tends to be the female. The female's larger than the males, and a bunch of smaller snakes pursuing that female. So if you see one larger and a bunch of smaller ones, that's likely the female giving off pheromones, which the males can then track to the female and pursue her and try to convince her.
They come
her
from
that
all directions.
Yep, and try to convince her that they're the one.
Dave and I were talking on a recent episode about the different reproductive strategies that snakes have. There were a couple complicated words. We were trying to get them straight. There was viviparous, which was what? Giving birth to live young?
Live young, yep.
There's oviparous, which is laying eggs that hatch on their own in some warmish spot.
Yes.
And then there's a third choice. And what is that?
Yep. Ovoviviparous.
Ovoviviparous, okay.
Yep. And and like everything in nature and ecology, nothing's as black and white as it may seem.
Yeah, we try to make it that way, don't we?
Right. And so about half of our snakes, a little bit less than our snakes in New Hampshire, actually will lay eggs in the wild. And so they'll lay them about the same time as turtles are laying eggs. And they'll develop underground. And that the eggs will hatch in later in the summer, in August.
And that can work because I know the strategy with turtles is they lay their eggs in a warm spot or a spot that gets a lot of sunlight.
Yes.
So that the eggs do have a bit of warmth and they're not going to chill. And so the development can continue.
Correct. Yep. Okay. And that tends to be the same with snakes. Okay. They tend to use mulch piles or compost areas or other soft substrate that they can get in and lay those eggs, rotting logs, et cetera.
So the ovoviviparous, that's a combination of the two in some ways in that they have an egg that develops, and the embryo develops in the egg, but it's inside the female.
Correct.
And then they hatch inside of the animal.
Correct. Right? And so they're born as live young, and they have a yolk sac attached associated with them where they're getting their nourishment, versus viviparous are animals that are primarily fed off of a placenta, and they don't have an egg associated with them, and they're born live.
Boy, cool stuff. So there's one thing we have to talk about, and that is that there's a lot of people that when they see a snake, they have a reaction, and it's not a reaction they can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah.
They recoil from the snake, and help us out with some of the truth about snakes and maybe why is it that people are so ambivalent about how to react to them. I mean, they see a warm, fuzzy mammal and it's no problem, but a snake is different.
Yeah, there's been some suggestion that even some of that fear is genetic. It's carried through evolution.
Evolutionary.
And that's certainly a possibility. I always try to ask people that are afraid of snakes about their childhood and how that came about. and it does seem to be at least in some cases, a strong learning component.
Like taught by your parents.
Yeah, a lot of the times there's a story behind that. Like when the person was a child, a story of their dad, you know, leaving a snake on their bike, or you know, something that really spooked them, and they carried through, or that their parents were scared and they carried that through.
Your dad. What do you teach your kids about snakes?
You know, my kids love snakes. My 2-year-old, my 5-year-old handle snakes. They have no fear of snakes, and. Yeah, so I think it's kids tend to love snakes, and somewhere along the line they sometimes learn to be afraid of snakes. But
So everyone thinks they know what a garter snake looks like, but turns out there's actually a variety of colorations of garter snakes, and I don't know if it ties to habitat or what. Can you explain what they look like and some of the variations?
Yeah, garter snakes have tremendous variation in physical appearance. And as I like to say, probably 99 out of every 100 snakes that people see are garter snakes.
Really?
And when people see something that they think is different than a garter snake, they tend to call us and ask what it is. And usually they send a photo in and I say, yep, that's a garter snake. it's a different coloration because, the true stereotypical form of a garter snake, they have three yellow stripes, one on the top and two on the sides. And that's what people are used to seeing, and that's how they get their name.
Okay.
The garters that used to attach from socks on gentlemen years ago. And so that's how their name carried through. But they often don't have those stripes. They can have a checkerboard pattern, and that often happens when animals, when their scales are spread. They actually have skin between their scales, and there's white flecks, and so it creates more of a checkerboard pattern.
Depending on how they're holding their scales.
Well, how their scales are spread. So when their scales are spread, you see the skin between the scales, and so it appears as more of a checkerboard compared to the stripes. And that can occur when, for a variety of reasons, that can occur when a snake has just consumed a meal and its body is stretched. Mm-hmm. It can also consumed when the animal is trying to puff up and look more intimidating and spread its scales out.
So are there one color garter snakes, like all black?
So there are varieties. Oftentimes they're black with yellow stripes, but there's everything in between. And we've even seen one report up in the White Mountains of a melanistic garter snake, an all-black garter snake. It was actually reported to us as a black racer.
Uh-huh.
But after investigating and looking at the scales, it was clear that it was not a racer and it was a...
That a unique individual or is there a population of all dark garter snakes?
That's the only individual that's been reported, but it would be a genetic aspect of the population. Mm-hmm. So there are likely other individuals, but it's probably a minor portion of the population.
You ever been bitten by a garter snake?
I have been bitten by a garter snake, yes.
Is there a problem with that?
It's like, any animal is going to do what they can to protect themselves when you catch on to them. Mm-hmm. I challenge you to catch a blue jay and see what it does to you. Yet most people aren't running away from blue jays when they're in the yard. They're feeding them and bringing them to their house. But a garter snake is not going to be much more than a scratch on your finger, certainly less than rubbing against any bramble bush.
So does a garter snake or any other, most of the New Hampshire's other snakes for that matter, have any other strategies for getting you to let them go?
Yeah, actually, the bite is the least of your worries when it comes to a garter snakes. They actually can excrete this pretty foul, musky smell and kind of release the contents of their intestines on you. So it's not something you... it's definitely smelly and it can stick with you for quite a while. It's the strongest of soap.
I've had that happen.
Yeah. and snakes, their reaction tends to be, at first sometimes they're a little defensive, but garter snakes, even large black racers, will calm down quite quickly once they realize that you're not a predator and you're not going to pose any harm to them.
So what method does a garter snake use to capture its prey? Does it chase it down or wait for it or what does it do?
Yeah, so garter snakes are pursuing and searching for their prey sources, and once they locate them, they're essentially grabbing onto them with their mouth. They have small teeth to basically hold on to prey, and they're essentially swallowing the prey alive.
Ooh, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
If you're the prey, at least.
Right. And so they don't have venom like our classic animals, like a rattlesnake. However, recent research has shown that a lot of different species, including garter snake, have kind of advanced saliva to help break down and paralyze prey. So it's venom-like qualities, but not something that's going to be dangerous to people. It's referred to as a neurotoxin, so it seems to be paralyzing.
That's just to calm the prey down.
Yeah, it seems to be calming the prey down.
So it doesn't kick on the way down.
So it seems to aid in the digestion and ease of consumption.
Interesting.
But
how does a snake swallow?
That's a good question.
Tell me how a snake swallows.
So we've witnessed snakes consuming some pretty impressive meals. We've had a picture that came in through our reptile amphibian reporting program once of a milk snake, a young milk snake, which they tend to eat other snakes. of eating a brown snake, which appeared to be as thick or longer than the milk snake.
Oh, my.
And I knew snakes could consume large meals, eat large meals, but I said, there's no way that that's going to work. And so I asked the person, I said, did you stay and watch? And she said, yep, and it finished the meal.
Are all snakes able to unhinge their jaws to take a large item in?
Yeah, so basically they'll unhinge their lower jaw, and they have very flexible jaws to basically...
Expand their throat.
Expand basically. Their mouth.
Wow.
And then they, you know, it's a slow process, but they basically work the prey down. A lot of times they you know, choose to take the item head first, but that's not always the case.
I was walking by a wetland one time, and I heard this squeaky sound. I couldn't find it at first,
yeah.
But finally I located it, and it was a garter snake, and it was squeaking.
Yeah.
And I realized, I got to the front of it, there were two frog legs sticking out of its mouth, and it was the frog that was yelling.
Yep.
From inside the garter snake.
Yep, seen that for sure, yep.
That was weird. That was really strange. That's pretty typical, isn't it?
Yeah, yep.
Is a frog saying to its friends, run, there's a snake here?
Well, nobody likes to be eaten alive.
Wow, I've learned a lot today from you, Mike. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming in to talk about snakes.
Yeah, no problem. Great to be here.
Mike Marchand is a wildlife biologist with New Hampshire Fish and Game. If you want to learn more about some of the critters you're seeing in your backyard, or you're wondering why you're not seeing certain critters in your backyard, send us an email at somethingwild@nhpr.org. We'll dig into it in a future edition. Until then, I'm Chris Martin. Something Wild is a joint production of New Hampshire Audubon, the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, and NHPR.
To know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.